Thank you for joining us for another Speaking of Schools. Today, the first in a three-part series from Furman University's summer series entitled Straight Talk SC. The series, presented by the Riley Institute at Furman and the Furman Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, is entitled Education for Life, Working Together to Fulfill the Promise of Education. Today's program was featured on June 7th on the Furman campus and is entitled Parents and Communities Fostering Lifelong Learners. We'll hear the introduction from Dr. Scott Henderson, and then we will briefly introduce each of the other speakers who were a part of this first program held at Furman University. So stay tuned for Parents and Communities Fostering Lifelong Learners. It's today's Speaking of Schools.
First of all, let me thank Ollie and the Riley Institute for the opportunity to be involved in the 2016 Straight Talk South Carolina series, which, as President Davis has already indicated, is appropriately entitled Education for Life. Before very briefly explaining some of the logistics, the structure of the series, let me convey greetings from Secretary Riley, who also sends his regrets for not being able to welcome you in person this evening. It will not surprise you that he had a scheduling conflict. He was called to a very important meeting in Washington, D.C. So they got me instead. Let me start by just saying this. There are two things, I think, that you will find in the newspaper every day: the weather forecast and an article about education. In this morning's Greenville News, there was an article about the suspension rate of African-American students versus white students. Now, I don't want to diminish the importance of the weather, but we don't pay taxes to support the local climate, and we don't vote for people on the basis of whether they favor partly sunny over partly cloudy, or vice versa. Education is something we need to continue to educate ourselves about for life, if for no other reason than to be active and informed citizens in a democracy. So again, welcome this evening. As many of you know, because you're here this evening, on three consecutive Tuesday evenings, including tonight, we will be hosting topic-based discussions. This evening, we will be giving most of our attention to early childhood education. Next Tuesday, we will be looking at the ways in which family and communities can support K-12 success. And on the third Tuesday evening, we will be looking at the way in which post-secondary institutions and post-secondary programs can help support what we see as a challenging K-12 demographic in South Carolina and elsewhere. On each of the Tuesday evenings, we will have guest speakers. While we're going to ask you to hold your questions to the end of the evening, we have provided you with note cards if you would like to jot a question down as it occurs to you. At break, you may put them in a basket in the back of the room, or if that question or questions occur to you during the second half of the session this evening, you may pass them to the aisle. We will then try to address as many of those questions from both the first half and the second half the last 10, 15 minutes of our time together. Of course, I have to tell you, because this is what we have to tell everyone these days, if you have a cell phone, please turn it off unless you want to respond to the live tweeting. I have to practice these words, okay? The live tweeting that we will be doing about the session. Now, when we first came in, up here, which it's not up here, there it is, okay, you may address comments to that tweeting at hashtag Straight Talk South Carolina. Otherwise, feel perfectly at ease to turn your phones off. All right, we're going to get started this evening because we know that your time is important. We've got a lot of exciting topics to discuss. So if you will allow me to introduce our first speaker, I will do so briefly, but the brevity should not in any way imply the lack of the importance of her work. The first speaker this evening is Dr. Sarah Ryder, who holds her medical degree from Penn State University, and she is currently on the faculty of the USC's School of Medicine, where she works at the Center for Pediatric Medicine and the Center for Family Medicine. And again, our focus tonight is going to be mostly on the links, the connections between early childhood experiences slash development and further educational opportunities, abilities, and success. So, Sarah?
Like Scott mentioned, my name is Sarah Ryder. I'm a physician here in the Greenville area and have been here in Greenville since August. And I have the pleasure tonight of talking to you about the essentials of early childhood development. I promise to make it not a totally boring science lesson. So my goals for tonight, I just want to go over some of the basic pathophysiology of early childhood development and then talk a little bit about how the early experiences that our kiddos have can impact their subsequent development. I also want to focus a little bit on language and early literacy, since that can be a key developmental area in kiddos' success. And then I want to talk about how we have some pretty effective programs that are already built into our community infrastructures that can emphasize and support early literacy and language development. So we'll dive right in. So this is just a little bit of a trajectory of development of three of the developmental domains. There are others, but this is just kind of an example. And what I'm hoping that this picture will demonstrate to y'all is that you have to build on basic skills before you can master more complex skills. And then also, I'm going to give you some examples that'll really go over why those different areas overlap. And so one developmental domain is not totally exclusive of the other. But first, let's talk about how our brains start. So everything starts forming when we're in utero, and our brains are no different. So in the last trimester of pregnancy, myelination, or an insulation that forms around our nerve cells, starts to develop. And that progresses all the way through adolescence and early adulthood. And it goes from back to front. And in doing so, it allows for progressive maturation of our motor, sensory, and then associative or executive functioning. That's why they always joke that teenagers don't have their frontal lobe myelinated yet. So let's take a walk through that progression. Remember, you have to start with the basics and build to more complex stuff. So as an example, a child can usually start to recognize their hands at about 3 months, and they show that by bringing their hands to the midline, right in their line of sight. So that can be a gross motor skill. And then eventually, they'll learn that if you put an object in their hand, they can grasp it. So that's a fine motor skill. And as they progress through 4, 5, and 6 months, they'll learn that not only can you hold something if it's placed in your hand, but you can reach for it. Then when you reach for it, you can close around it and bring it back to you, pass it to the other side. That's all a progression through fine motor skills. They can also then realize that when they hold that object in their hand, they can voluntarily release it. And then, when it falls to the floor and out of their line of sight, they eventually develop something called object permanence, which is where they remember it exists even if they can't see it. So they'll look for it. That's a cognitive skill, so you can see the overlap there. And then, the really exciting part, for those of you who have had kids, they realize that if they drop it, someone will pick it up for them. Yeah. So then they've learned that they can influence their social environment and they can have that social interaction. So you can see that you have to start with the basics and build upward, and that nothing is exclusive of the other domain. You need all of them. So then let's think about how external things can impact that early development. The plasticity or malleability of the brain is really highest in the first year of life. So that's where we can make our biggest impact with these kiddos. You see, they're born with all the nerve cells that you're ever going to have, the neurons in their brain, but the connections or synapses between those are up for grabs, and they're largely influenced by the things that happen to that child. The peak of those synapses usually occurs at about 3 years of age, and then they whittle out the ones that are less high yield by the time they reach adolescence. So a great example of this is learning multiple languages. We all sort of anecdotally know that it's better to learn a language when you're young than to try and learn it when you're old. I've sat in front of Rosetta Stone. It's not that easy. But research really supports that. So in fact, when they've looked at, they've done non-invasive neural imaging of kiddos that learned languages as toddlers versus those that learned it as adolescents, they have entirely different neural connections or pathways. So if you learn it as a child, when you're very young, before you go through puberty, how your brain connects looks very different than if you learned it as an adolescent or adult. Additionally, kids that learn a language as an adolescent or after they've gone through puberty will never really reach grammatical proficiency of a native speaker versus kids that learn it as an infant or a toddler. Taking that a step further, let's step out of the language realm and think about social things that can impact a child. Remember, an infant is entirely dependent on someone else for their physical and emotional needs. They cannot change their own diaper. They cannot mix up their own bottle. They need someone else to do that. If they have a constant environment where they go through the same routine, they have the same people around them, they're in the same location, they can habituate to all that similar stimuli, which opens them up to recognizing novel stimuli. So they can learn from those things and be stimulated by different events and create those neural connections. Another way to think about it is if they have a trusted caregiver who's always there, they can develop that secure attachment with their caregiver. And that helps them develop their social emotional connections. They did some research that showed that children that were picked up when they were having distress crying during their first year of life were less aggressive at 2 years of age and less likely to cry at 1 year of age. So they really thrive on that first year and all the things that impact it. So then, let's move on to language and literacy. This is a particularly great area, I think. So, why do we care about language and literacy? First of all, exposing kiddos to language is one of the best things you can do for them. Giving them, for example, reading a book, you're exposing them to cadence of a conversation, short repetitive phrases, and lots of different words. And that can really cultivate those synapses or neural connections that we were just talking about. Additionally, we know that learning language and literacy is important when it comes to education. So there have been some educational statistics that have come out that showed that only about 20% of four-year-olds living below the poverty line can recognize all 26 letters of the alphabet. If you compare that to their same-age peers that are living at or above the poverty line, they recognize about 37% of the time. So I know that 37%, not a robust statistic, we have room to work on there, but I think the take-home message there is the gap. So in kids living below the poverty line versus those living at or above it, there's a 17% difference in who can recognize all 26 letters of the alphabet. Then in the US alone, thinking about reading proficiency, let me get my percentages here so I tell you the right thing. When we're thinking about reading proficiency in these kiddos, only about 30% of first graders can read on grade level. Only 30%, that's 70% who can't. Obviously, that has downstream effects when it comes to school absences, school avoidance, dropout, and lack of graduation. And then, to take that even further, we know that reading on a third grade proficiency level is one of the most important predictors of subsequent graduation and career success. But if you look at kids from lower socioeconomic status, only about 20% reach that proficiency in time. It's 80% who aren't meeting that mark. So we have a lot of work to do in that area. And obviously, starting younger and starting earlier is important. And then thinking about what is at the core of literacy. So I think when we think of literacy, we think about sitting down with a book and reading words on a page. But really, when you think about that with a child and a parent or an adult, it's so much more than that. In that moment, it's not just reading words. It's sharing those pictures, sharing that story, having that one-on-one social emotional connection. Kids love that, right? Like, kids love when you pay attention to them. So if you're paying attention to them with a book, they will associate that activity with positivity, and they'll be more likely to want to do it. So not only are you helping them with their language development, but you're also helping them form that social-emotional connection. All right. And Dan, who comes up a little bit later tonight, is also going to talk about this. But this is just a graph from the Hart-Risley study. For those of y'all that aren't familiar with this study, it was a longitudinal study done in the 1990s in Kansas. They took families from Kansas and split them up into three different socioeconomic classes. So professional, working class, and welfare. And what they did is they went and sat in 42 families' homes over 3 years and recorded their conversations, analyzed those, and then followed up with those kids when they were 9 years old. They found a pretty striking difference in word exposure. So in the kiddos that were in the professional families, on average, they were exposed to about 1,500 more words per day than the peers in other socioeconomic classes. If you extrapolate that out to when those kids are getting ready to start school, that's 30 million words more that they were exposed to. That's a pretty significant amount. I don't even know that I know 30 million words. But I think the take-home message there is that's a pretty significant gap depending on the socioeconomic class that you're in. And again, highlights that we need to make some big strides when it comes to early childhood education and development. All right. So I want to talk just a little bit. There are a ton of programs out there. I did a presentation with the ICS folks at the Smart Start Conference. It was all about literacy programs. So I could talk your ear off about that, but I won't. I'll just share a handful with you. This is one of the ones that I'm most familiar with. It's one of our most evidence-based interventions. It's Reach Out and Read. It's an intervention that occurs most primarily in a physician's office and builds on that medical provider-parent-child relationship. Here in South Carolina, it's in all of our pediatric residency programs, and we're working to get it in the family medicine, all the family medicine residency programs. But what happens at this intervention is that anytime a kiddo comes for their well child check, from 6 months to 5 years, although Reach Out and Read of the Carolinas is working to go birth to 5 years, those kiddos will get an age-appropriate book that they get to take home. And the parents get some age-appropriate literacy guidance. Because I don't know if you've, even as a physician, I try to look at kids' books, and it can be hard to tell sometimes what's appropriate for a 3-year-old versus a 4-year-old versus a 5-year-old. So they get to take those books home, and we as medical providers get to use that as sort of a window into what's happening at home. So I can tell you that I can learn a ton about a family's interaction once I hand that book to that kiddo. If they open it and know what to do with it and look at their parents and say, look at this book, and they point out pictures, I mean, that's like basically my developmental exam or a large portion of it. In the same token, if a child gets a book and looks at it and doesn't really know what to do with it and kind of throws it on the floor, goes to play on their iPad, I also get a pretty good idea of what's happening in the home, and that gives me a window to kind of talk about what we can do when they're not in my office. This was actually, I think, a really neat idea. It was a study out of Temple University, pretty low-cost intervention. You can see it only cost about $60. What they did is they basically put up signs in grocery stores in different neighborhoods. Some days they were up, some days they were not, and they just had someone sit and observe parents talking to their kiddos. So an example of what one sign might say is, I come from a cow. Can you think of anything else that comes from a cow? And they would hang it near the dairy section. And what they found is that by putting up those signs in low-income community grocery stores, they increased language-rich conversation betwixt family members by 33%. For $60, that's a pretty good deal. Not a terribly strenuous intervention, and it can have potentially a big impact. And then lastly, I just want to highlight libraries and museums. I think they're a pretty obvious place to talk about language and literacy, but oftentimes forgotten these days with the internet and Google and all the things that are out there. But the libraries actually are really supportive of language and literacy. In 2010, they offered over 2 million programs to kids under 11 years of age. And these are just a couple examples. Every Child Ready to Read and Family Place Library. Family Place Library is in about 26 states, and it is spreading. But both of these interventions, as well as many of the other ones that are similar to those, focus on really cultivating parents as teachers, right? We can do all the things that we want to do in the schools and all the things we want to do in physicians' offices, but really the people who are going to be your point person for that child are going to be the caregivers. So this really focuses on getting them the appropriate information that they need to provide good language and literacy to their kiddos. And with that, I am going to end my portion of the talk, and I look forward to answering y'all's questions. Thank you very much.
And that was Dr. Sarah Ryder, pediatrician and clinical assistant professor at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine in Greenville. The next speaker is Susan Alford. Susan is the state director for the South Carolina Department of Social Services. Her topic, creating good foundations for early learners.
I want to start by giving you a little bit of an idea about Department of Social Services. Many of you know us mostly from reading about us in the newspaper. What I wanted to do is to start by talking to you a little bit about the fact that the agency, in many ways, folks don't understand the scope of it and also the task that we have at hand. Hopefully, if I can move us forward here. And then obviously one of the things that I want to do in my short presentation is to talk to you about the connection between child welfare and education, because there's a huge connection in particular between abuse and neglect and early childhood education, and I want to try to make that case for you as we talk. But I want to start by just telling you that Department of Social Services is a huge agency, 4,000 employees, $792 million that comes through that agency. And we have three core functions. Now, most of you know of us by hearing about what we do in the area of child abuse and neglect. So when you look at Strong Families, that really depicts everything that we do that has to do with the investigation and taking care of children that have been abused or neglected. But what a lot of folks don't know is that we also have that same function for vulnerable adults. So we are also the state agency charged to work with vulnerable adults, and that's anybody from 18 to wherever, that cannot take care of themselves, and they have to be court-ordered to be in our care. But if an adult is disabled in some way and cannot take care of themselves, they can be court-ordered to come in our care, and we oftentimes have to act in loco parentis for older folks as well as for children. So when you look at what we do with children, again, with child abuse and neglect, it ranges for everything from investigation to taking children in custody with the family court and law enforcement to foster care, which, again, most folks know us by. And then the ultimate thing that we look at is permanency for children. So what we also do is adoption. And what we say at DSS all the time is that the happiest day we have at DSS is adoption day. There's really nothing quite like it, to find that permanent family for a child that's been abused or neglected, and to see the joy for both of the parents and also the children. Then the second thing that we do is provide economic assistance. Now, again, you may be familiar with the fact that we do that, and I'll use some old acronyms that we really don't use anymore. But for instance, we provide food assistance, which many of you may know as food stamps. We also provide economic assistance to families that are below poverty. Again, our acronym for that is TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. We also regulate child care centers, so we provide licensure of child care, and I'll talk about that in a minute, in particular, how that relates to early childhood education. And then the third picture I have here is we work in child support. So again, we are known for the collection of child support, and we do collect quite a bit of it from fathers, sometimes from mothers across the state. But we also have fatherhood initiatives. So one of the big things that DSS is mandated to do is not only collect child support so that families will be more stable, but also to help provide forms for fathers to be more engaged, not just financially with their children, but also emotionally and physically with their children. So we do quite a bit on this, and I'll highlight the degree to which we do this in just a few slides. I promise I won't share too many statistics. I just want to start by telling you that our agency touches 1 in 4 South Carolinians. We have a huge impact in this state, 1.2 million folks per year. And the way we touch them, I mentioned child abuse and neglect. If you just see a little bit of the statistics there, we take in about 19,608 cases each year. But of those, about a third of those are actually founded. And what founded means in DSS language is it means that after an investigation, we determined that indeed there was child abuse and neglect that occurred. And when we find that out, then we accept that case and it goes into either foster care or one of our other programs. So we take in a lot more cases than we found, but the founding of a case is a very big part of what we do at DSS, is to do the investigation and to find out whether or not that case actually did happen. We serve with food assistance, or SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. We serve 382,000 households per month. $101 million and 809,000 people. When you look at financial assistance, or TANF, we serve 27,000 people per month, and most of these are children. In other words, we're providing economic assistance to parents, but the money also is targeted to the children that are in that household. When you look at child care, one of the very big pushes that we have in our agency, and one of the things that we're mandated to do, is to try to provide subsidies for child care so that folks that are on assistance can provide child care for their children. And we give subsidies at the level of 24,550 children. The reason that's particularly important is that the old mindset around welfare was that, you know, people could stay on welfare for years and years and years and not get off. That's changed. It's one of the biggest misconceptions, actually, about social services. The federal law requires, and we are required to, move folks off of assistance and help them get work. And when they do get jobs, one of the biggest things that you're trying to do is you're trying to get them to be able to then put their children in child care, because once they do get jobs, then they've got to pay for child care oftentimes. So being able to help them get subsidies to child care is a very big part of what DSS has to do when we get federal dollars to try to support that process. And then in terms of child support, again, our fatherhood engagement is one of our big focuses. We work with the South Carolina Center for Children and Families, Fatherhood and Families, to try to do a lot of work on fatherhood engagement. But in collections alone, I just wanted to put up one statistic. Last year, we collected $290 million. That's a massive effort. The typical caseload for a child support worker in South Carolina is 692 parents, which again is a very big issue that we've got to resolve in our agency. Now, I bring that all up because I want to try to connect this in some way to education. And I want to just see if I can illustrate for you the connections that all make this a very real thing for children that are abused and neglected. Because what ends up happening for the most part in our system, the people that come to our attention, is that all the things that I described all connect with cycles of abuse and neglect. So if you have a family who does not have food, healthy food and nutrition, if you have a family that does not have the folks that don't have jobs and they're not bringing in dollars, if they're uneducated, if their children are not receiving education, if they are divorced oftentimes, if they're single mothers or single fathers, and if there's drugs or violence in their families, you see those cycles and those connections happening over and over again, especially in families that come in our care. It's not unusual at all to see a child that comes in for abuse and neglect whose parents were also abused or neglected. In fact, it's more common than not. And so one of the big focuses that we have is that when you start talking about how is it that you work with children that are abused and neglected, you can't just get at working with the victim. You've got to work with the parent. You've got to work with schools. You've got to work with the economy in terms of trying to provide them the support system that they need. You've got to work on issues regarding domestic violence. You've got to work on drug abuse. If you look at the number one connector with child fatalities in this state, a lot of folks don't realize this. I don't see child fatalities that don't have drugs involved in them. It's a parent oftentimes who's abusing drugs. Sometimes it's a parent that is under the influence and a child dies because of unsafe sleep. But there are oftentimes connections between those things. And education in particular is one thing that really does connect oftentimes to the number one referral that we get at DSS for folks. The number one referral is not abuse, it's neglect. And that's the number one reason why children come into our care. So we're looking at family cycles of abuse, and you're looking at a very complicated job, because what you're trying to do in an agency, a child welfare agency, is you're trying to work and be able to provide a better family for children oftentimes, but you start with trying to keep that child in their biological family and trying to work with them so you don't have to remove them from care. In order to do that, you've got to work with everything that that parent didn't get, everything that those parents are not doing well. If the parent is uneducated, if the parent doesn't have a job, if the parent is drug and alcohol addicted, you've got to work on that as well, because otherwise the child's not going to be able to remain in the home. Then, if you're not able to get the family to stabilize, then you've got to look at who could that child live with. And we do something right now in DSS a lot of, is we have a big emphasis on kin caregivership. So what we mean by that is, if there is a member of the family that's willing to take that child in, and you can keep that child with their siblings and in their biological unit, you're asking grandmother and grandfather and aunt and uncle, would you be willing to take care of this child so the child doesn't have to go in foster care? We just got passed this year some subsidies to be able to give subsidies to kin caregivers, the same that you could give to a foster parent. Because a lot of folks would like to take children in, but they can't because they can't afford to do it. So we have to break cycles. And we have to break cycles not just as an agency, but we have to partner with lots of people that do prevention work. We partner with Children's Trust, with First Steps, with a lot of agencies to be able to do a lot of the work that really gets at how do you stabilize families. Because our goal is to get permanency for children. We want them to be in a permanent home. And not to move from home to home. And that's one of the things that we work very hard to do. So in terms of the fact that neglect is our number one referral, I don't have that statistic up here, but it's about 70% of the referrals we get are for neglect. You're looking at the typical perpetrator of neglect is a woman. She's more often white than a minority. And 75% are in their 20s and 30s. So your typical perpetrator of neglect in South Carolina is a single woman, white female, and a young woman who has no support system. And oftentimes neglect, again, is the reason why she has either been neglected herself in her life or she brings a cycle of neglect to her children. And I just put this slide up, which reminds me very much of what we were just talking about in terms of early development. If you just look at the brain of a three-year-old and you look at the brain of a normal child and then one that's had extreme neglect, there's so much research to basically indicate that neglect in particular can have a devastating impact on children. And under the age of five in particular, even though trauma and abuse is also equally traumatic in terms of a lot of the what it perpetuates in a child's life, neglect is absolutely the number one thing that we look at in terms of how is it that we can help families get out of a cycle of neglect and abuse, and how is it that we can really look at the deficits that a child will inherit if they haven't been reading, if they haven't been talked to, if they haven't been cuddled, if they haven't received all of those different things that children need. And so neglect is an extremely, unfortunately, powerful predictor of problems for a child in the future. And then, of course, you hear a lot about domestic violence. South Carolina, unfortunately, is near the top of the list in the state in terms of our rates of domestic violence. But it's staggering to think that 4 out of 5 families repeat domestic violence. Again, this whole notion of neglect and abuse, We need to always remember this, not just children oftentimes that are traumatized just because they've been abused, it's also because they witness it. And their witnessing abuse of their parents and others in the home is just as traumatic as if they were abused themselves. So children that are caught in these cycles, again, will have major deficits as they get older. And South Carolina, unfortunately, is near the top of the heap in terms of that issue. Now, I always have a hard time talking about DSS without really just sounding bleak. Because what we do is so serious. It really is. It's so serious. And I have to tell you, as a director of an agency of this size, there's nothing like waking up in the morning and knowing that even on the worst day that you ever have, you will make so much impact on a child. We have that much impact on children. So it's a terrific responsibility, but it's also a terrific challenge. And our department works very, very hard to try to keep our heads above water right now. And if you read about us in the paper, you know that we have tremendous challenges, caseloads and turnover and all kinds of things. But one of the things I just want to bring up to you is the fact that we understand completely that it's that first 5 years of a child's life where we really have to focus. We've got to really pay a lot of attention to what happens with children when they're very young, because it does imprint them for life. And our responsibility is to try to interrupt cycles of abuse. Well, that five-year-old is somebody that we really look at very, very seriously. And a lot of what we try to do, even in permanency, is we try not to let children linger in foster care so that they do get a permanent home, again, during this period of time in which they are so imprintable. So, you know, of the 29,000 kids we serve every year, 41% of them are under the age of five. So we have this tremendous responsibility, not just to take children into our custody, but we have to really focus on them. And we just understand that it's during this period of time that we really got to make the best strides. We do that through a lot of prevention efforts. We do that through working with other agencies that we feel like really do it better than we do. Because our arm of it, unfortunately, is when children are in trouble. But we try to work with education. We try to work with prevention, with social service agencies, with community nonprofits, to try to make our focus on prevention. Because, again, we know that this child will end up being a parent one day, too. And we want to break those cycles. One of the things that we say all the time is that every moment counts and every single interaction with that child matters. So we have to be really serious and dedicated to making sure that the programs that we use, that they work. I'm very focused on making sure that we get good outcomes out of our programs that we use. And we want to make sure that children really are getting the benefit. And, you know, it takes a lot of work to really figure out whether or not what you're doing is making an impact. And we're doing a process right now through our OWL agency where we're just going through and looking at our core functions, and we're trying to make sure that everything that we do has some impact. And if it doesn't, then we don't want to do it anymore. And we want to do things that we know are really going to work. So one of the things that we do, you'll hear some about First Steps later, we partner with First Steps to try to provide training and education in our child care centers, in addition to the fact that in child care, what we're trying to do is, you know, make sure that children are fed appropriately, and we're trying to make sure that they're supervised, but we also are trying to make sure that they learn and that they learn well, that they have technology they need, and that they really can become more educated earlier and earlier. We partner with Head Start. We partner with lots of folks to be able to focus on this young child, because we really believe that focusing on the young child will have a major payout later. And I just want to end by telling you one brief story. I've had the privilege of working in a lot of programs. One of the programs that is probably always struck me as being a complete synthesis of what I was just talking about is a program that we run called New Horizons Family Center, and it's in a town named Somerton, South Carolina. I don't know if any of you ever vacation on Lake Marion, but Somerton is on the shores of Lake Marion. But it's a program that I worked with when I was in Clemson, and ironically, DSS funds it. So you can imagine I've made it even better. And it's a program where we take girls that have been in foster care, and they've gotten pregnant while they were in foster care. They've had their babies, And in the past, what would happen is the baby would go into foster care, and the girl would go, was already in foster care, and then they would not be reunited. So what we did was we created a program where we would bring them together, and we would take a 16-year-old girl or 15-year-old girl and her baby, and if she wanted to keep that baby, we would work with them for a number of years until she was able to leave with a job, you know, with a home, and not go back to the home that she came from. It is a wonderful program, but it was a wonderful program for me to work in. But one of the things that I still always picture even on a bad day at DSS, when I'm dealing with legislators and when I'm, yeah, I can say that because the legislation with the session just ended. But when things are really sort of just rocking and rolling, one of the things I always remember is this vision that we had of creating a reading room for the babies, for the toddlers. And one of the things that was so touching to me was we would try to encourage these girls to read to their children. And it was so poignant because, you know, those of us that have lived, a fairly good life and have had supportive parents, you just don't think about that as a big deal. And to see a teenager struggle to read to her child, it's really just something that just, it still hits me. It just hits me right here. To think about if she didn't get that, if she didn't get that kind of, you know, that kind of attention and that kind of support from her parents, what a gift it is for her to give it to her child and for them to struggle with it. I can remember we had a mural where we had a tree painted on the wall, and I remember, and it was, you were supposed to sit under the tree and read to your child. And I remember one of the girls just sitting there with her baby, and she looked up at me at one point and she said, "I just never thought I'd like Goodnight Moon." And she said, "But about the eighth time I read it, I finally got it." And of course her child would just be sitting there just adoringly looking at her. But it's just that whole idea that we take for granted that children know these things, that they've had that kind of care, that they've had that kind of attention. And to see them understand the power of words and the power of touch and what that does for their children, it's just a remarkable way to see that legacy and that cycle broken. And we had an absolute 100% success rate. But it was because we took the time and took lots and lots and lots of work for teenagers to learn how to be good moms, but also for them to become independent and be able to leave. And we had, when I say we were successful, what I mean is that none of these babies did not leave with their moms. So in other words, they went with their mother and stayed with their mother afterwards. And I tell you, at the end of one of my days, that's a great story. That's a great story. So I want to close by just telling you that this work is very serious, but at the same time, this work is very heartwarming and uplifting, and we do see success. But what we really concentrate on every single time we look at a child is we concentrate on what kind of parent that child is going to be, because we know better than any agency that it's cycles and intergenerational cycles that you have to break. So I really applaud the work that folks do in early childhood education, love the partnerships that we have, and we'll continue to make sure we focus on future generations. Thank you.
Susan Alford, the director of the South Carolina Department of Social Services, addressing the audience at Furman University for the first session of Straight Talk SC, Parents and Communities Fostering Lifelong Learners. The third speaker of the evening was Dan Worry. Dan is Deputy Director for South Carolina First Steps, and he spoke on early investment for a lifetime of results.
I want to begin by just saying a quick word of thanks to Furman and Ole and to the Riley Institute. It is a real treat to be here, an honor to be here in this room, and such a special thing, this summer series that they put on. What an asset to the community. And I want to say a word of thanks to you as well for taking time out this evening to come and join us in this conversation, which I consider to be maybe the most important public policy conversation we can be having in South Carolina. And that is the question of how we are going to support the roughly 336,000 young children under the age of five in South Carolina. Now, I know that I will be preaching to the choir, as it were, in this room when I tell you, as a South Carolinian, I am frustrated, as I'm sure you are, by seeing so often the state of South Carolina listed at the bottom of the lists that we know we need to be aspiring to be at the top of. Susan mentioned in some cases we're at the top of lists that we know we don't want to be at the top of. So if we could sort our lists out, that would be great. But one of the good news stories that I want to tell you tonight is that that is not the case for early childhood education. South Carolina actually has a very progressive, a very forward-thinking approach to early childhood education, which is so important, and I want to share a little bit this evening about some of the major policy investments that South Carolina has made in young children. If you follow education news at all, you might be aware that over the past couple of years in particular, there has been a lot of conversation about the expansion of four-year-old kindergarten, or pre-K, pre-kindergarten, not only in South Carolina, where we have expanded a fair amount, but really across the country. Legislatures from coast to coast have added here over just even the past couple of years hundreds of millions of dollars in expansion of four-year-old pre-kindergarten. One of the things you may not know, though, that is really saying something special about South Carolina, South Carolina's four-year-old kindergarten program is actually celebrating this year its 32nd birthday. Take a moment and soak that in about South Carolina. It really is something special, and I will tell you, I mentioned this in part, let's see if I can, oh, here we go. I mention this in part because it is the first of a number of policy innovations that I want to make sure that you are aware of that relate to early childhood education. But I think it's especially fitting in this room, in this context, that we begin with four-year-old kindergarten because it was begun under the leadership of a visionary governor whose name happens to be on the podium in front of me. And it is a shame that the Governor Riley wasn't able to be here tonight so that we could all thank him together for his vision. But just as a little bit of an indication, you can see on this slide as to how forward-thinking Governor Riley was in that sense to get a statewide pre-kindergarten program going in 1984. That was 12 years before the state committed to full-day five-year-old kindergarten. So the the first pre-K programs in South Carolina were created as part of the Education Improvement Act, which you may know is a 1 cent sales tax that you probably contributed to today already. It continues to fund throughout the state pre-kindergarten and a whole list of important educational programs. It is a dedicated source of funding for education. It's not the only source of education funding, but certainly a dedicated one in South Carolina. And that is, so as early as 1984, we had a statewide presence. It was a relatively small scale program, but certainly happening in every school district. We began phasing in full-day five-year-old kindergarten in 1996 over a three-year period. In 1999, I'm very excited to say that I was there for part of this and still there. South Carolina First Steps to School Readiness was created. We are the state's comprehensive early childhood education initiative, and I will talk a little bit about the kinds of programs that we fund a little bit later on here as we go. In 2005, you may know, there was already a reference earlier this evening to the Abbeville court case. This is the school equity funding lawsuit that has been going on in South Carolina now for more than 20 years. A group of 37 rural school districts brought suit against the state of South Carolina, claiming that it was unconstitutional the way that we fund public education, particularly in these rural communities where they lack an industry base and a revenue base. That case was partially settled in 2005. Circuit Court Judge Thomas Cooper ruled against initially the school districts at that point, but what he said was that the state was not fulfilling its constitutional obligation, in particular to young children in poverty. And so two things happened as a result of that during the 2006 legislative session. One was that First Steps was reauthorized, and the other was the creation of a really innovative new approach to four-year-old kindergarten in both the public and the private sectors. You probably know that the years of early childhood have not traditionally been the realm of school districts, right? That for very young children, it's been churches and private preschools and families that have really provided those services. And so when the General Assembly sought to expand four-year-old kindergarten through what they called the Child Development Education Pilot Program, CDEP, they chose to do it in both public school settings through the Department of Education and in a series of private preschools around the state. We currently run that in about 200 private preschool providers around the state through First Step. So we have been proud to co-administer that program. In 2014, we were reauthorized once more. And then the other thing that is important there in 2014 was the Read to Succeed Act. You may have heard of this. Read to Succeed is a third grade reading proficiency bill. And many states, particularly in the Southeast, have moved in this direction, where children who are not reading proficiently by the third grade stand the chance of being retained in a grade level if they are not reading proficiently by that point. One of the sort of legislative compromises in that conversation was, if we're going to talk about retaining children in the third grade, then we need to make sure before they get to the third grade that we have given them every opportunity not to be retained. And so one of the things that happened as part of Read to Succeed was that that CDEP, that 4K pilot program in the public and private sectors, after 8 years, was formally codified into law. And so now it is very nearly the law all across the state. I will tell you, you may know, Greenville County is one of the remaining districts. We are currently in 64 of 81 school districts in the state. Those that are remaining tend to be those with the smallest sort of per capita percentage of free and reduced lunch. And so Greenville, Charleston, parts of Columbia, really our most populous, more suburban school districts at this point continue not to be, although I would expect in the next couple of years we'll see the General Assembly move in that direction. So why is investing in early childhood the way that South Carolina has an important thing? Sarah sort of went into this using a couple of bigger words than I'm going to. The issue here is, I mean, and she laid it out so nicely, 90% of brain development happens before the age of five. Think about that. This is like building a house, right? If you have a strong foundation on which everything else is built, you're generally going to be in pretty good shape. Can you fix a foundation in your house when things go wrong after the fact? You can, but you know what? It's real costly, and it doesn't necessarily work as well, right? So, and that's sort of the same thing here. So investing during the time that this unique window of development is happening is awfully important. So we know this from a positive standpoint. We also know, looking at some South Carolina data, that we have good evidence now that adverse experiences during the first couple of years of a child's life tend to predict their failure by the third grade. And I know this is a real data-heavy table, so I'll give you kind of the cheat sheet here. The idea was, this was a study that Dr. Baron Holmes, who some of you may be aware of, he ran Kids Count for a number of years in South Carolina, helped us with several years back. What he did was he looked at a cohort of third grade students in South Carolina, and what he did was he pulled out those children who by the third grade fell into one of two categories of early school failure. First, he looked at kids who were too old to be in the third grade. You know what that means, is that they have likely been retained in a grade level, so have in essence failed a grade level prior to getting to the third grade. He also then looked at the kids who were in the bottom 25% of the state standardized test. And we have a really unique opportunity and ability in South Carolina through what we call our data warehouse to look at some of the demographic figures. So Dr. Holmes was able to take these kids who were not performing up to par in third grade and was able to look backward in these children's lives to look at what were the risk factors that they faced during early childhood that might be predictive of them failing by the third grade. You see here on the far left a list of risk factors, any one of which gave these children statistically in South Carolina a 1 in 3 chance of falling into that failure by the third grade category. Up at the top, and these are the kids that Susan is certainly working with at DSS, children who are abused, neglected, placed into foster care. If you are placed into foster care, 53% of those children, by the time they reach the third grade, will have either been retained in South Carolina or will be in the bottom 25% in the state standardized test. So that's sort of how you can read this chart. As you see, there are a number of factors that relate to low birth weight, right? Which is not surprising. We know that children who are born prematurely tend to lag developmentally and have some issues there. An awful lot of these, though, relate to poverty. Those kids who qualify for TANF benefits that Susan was talking about here just a few minutes ago, those are families that are at 50% or less of the federal poverty definition, which is, Susan, you probably could spout off the number better than I could, but you know, we're talking about a single parent and a child who, you know, exist for a year on less than $10,000, roughly. Food stamps, or SNAP as it's now called, at 130% of poverty. But you see the impact in these figures that poverty plays in helping to shape and determine the long-term success of these kids, particularly during their early childhood years. Births to teenage mothers as well is a big factor on here as well. So Sarah sort of talked about this as well, but take a look. These lines show the neural connections, right? So we were talked about having all of the brain cells, but making those connections between the cells. The shaded area that you see with this very high kind of prevalence of brain growth and those neural connections, that's during the first year of life. And if you look at those lines, those relate to sensory connections, to language, and to higher cognitive functions. It's really shocking in a way to see this sort of data and to understand just how consequential the first year alone is, right? So all the more reason that we should be looking at how to invest. I know I don't think this has a laser pointer, but you can see there as we start to number out past the purple shading there, you know, things in terms of those connections happening drop off very sharply, particularly after age 5. And so creating that good foundation early on is especially critical. This is the same graph Sarah mentioned that I was going to show it as well. I just want to emphasize once more how absolutely critical early language development is in shaping later cognitive function. These children that as they were able to assess, we're talking about a gap of 30 million words by age 3. Now, that's not a vocabulary. That's the words that the children have been exposed to. The vocabulary actually is some of what's listed out there in the boxes. But you can see, you know, the children of professional families in this study, by 36 months, had more than twice the vocabulary of their lower income, less advantaged peers. Why does this matter? Have you ever tried to read something that was in a topic that you didn't understand? Have you ever tried? I'm sure Sarah used a word earlier that we probably all didn't understand, right? So, if you read a medical journal, chances are good, if that's not something that you are, steeped in, that you may be able to pronounce some of those words. You certainly won't comprehend them, and that's really what reading is all about. But it goes even more deep than reading. It gets really to the very way in which we think. The two different theorists have posited this in different ways, but language after a certain point is more than just the content of what we can think. After a certain point in early childhood, language actually helps to form the structure of cognition itself, right? Try to think, as you are sitting, probably thinking this guy needs to hush and go sit down. You're doing it in words, right? So imagine how consequential this is. I mean, this early exposure to language not only is helping to shape what children are thinking, but literally is shaping how children are thinking, and I think that's awfully important. What we have found, though, generally from a public policy perspective, is that we are investing potentially at all the wrong times. What these two lines show are brain size by age, so you see that the blue line there shows that very rapid growth during the early years of life. The bottom line shows public investment by age, right? We tend to invest very, very little historically. Now, this is not South Carolina data. This is from a national study from several years back. But the gist of it is not so much that we look at numbers, but to understand. Think about how we make investments in children, right? We start sending them to public school things. We start making those sizable investments now, maybe in some cases when they're 4, but generally from the time they're 5 until the time they're about 17, and then they go on to college. We pay lots and lots, and we invest lots and lots during a time of life after which, or after this very consequential period of brain development, which is something that I think we would be wise to look at carefully as a state. This is data from James Heckman, if that name sounds familiar. He is a Nobel laureate in economics. He works at the University of Chicago and has done a lot of modeling around the benefits of investing in early childhood. What you see here is sort of the declining return on investment, with the greatest rate of return being in programs that are serving very young children from the prenatal during that first year of life with that rapid brain development. Programs targeted toward the early years, having a very high return, preschool programs, and then eventually that return on investment dipping off as children get older. I keep saying to lawmakers, if I could tell you, you know, if you could invest a dollar with me and I could save you $6, $8, $10 later, would you want to do it? And the answer is always, in theory, yes. That's what we see here. Several of these landmark studies, the Abecedarian Project was a preschool study conducted at the University of North Carolina. Nurse Family Partnership is an evidence-based program, a nurse home visitation program that you'll hear more about later in the evening. The Perry Preschool Project was a preschool study in Ypsilanti, Michigan, conducted back in the 1960s. They have now tracked the progress of those children, the life outcomes of those children, for more than 40 years. What they have found is not only that those children who had a high-quality preschool experience achieved better educationally, but they achieved better in a whole host of life outcomes. They're more likely to be stably married. They're more likely to be homeowners. They're more likely not to have gone to prison. The list goes on and on and on. But you see the rate of return, that dotted line is sort of the dollar back for every dollar invested. We know that investing in programs for young children is a very cost-effective and actually something that stands to save taxpayers a good bit. So again, James Heckman talking about a 7 to 10% return on investment per annum, so a yearly return on that investment of 7 to 10% in all of those things. I know I've got just a moment or two. I want to tell you a little bit quickly about South Carolina First Steps to School Readiness. Again, we are the school readiness agency for the state. One of the things that we do through our state board and through our state office is help to underwrite a collection. There are 46 local nonprofit First Steps partnerships. So no matter what county you live in South Carolina, there is a local First Steps office. In fact, I don't know where'd Derek go. Wave, Derek. Oh, Derek's in the back. So Derek Lewis, who is our director of Greenville County First Steps, is here in the room, and somebody that you ought to seek out before the night is over to figure out how you might support. So those partnerships receive funding through the General Assembly and through private sources. They have the opportunity each year to do a needs and resources assessment and to propose how it is that they will fill gaps in early childhood services community by community. You probably know Greenville County has very different needs from Allendale County, has very different resources, and so it's a very localized model, but generally speaking, they support and help to underwrite programming in these 6 different lines of work. Health programs like Nurse Family Partnership, family strengthening programs, parent education programs like Parents as Teachers, for example. Early intervention, we are the state lead agency for a program you may have heard of called BabyNet. It's the early childhood, early intervention program for infants and toddlers with disabilities and developmental delays. We work extensively with childcare, with early childhood classroom-based preschool programs, and also you may have heard of Countdown to Kindergarten, which is a school transition program. We help to take high-risk rising 5-year-old kindergartners and match them up with the person who is going to be their kindergarten teacher during the summer prior to kindergarten entry. It's been something that teachers have come back for year after year and really have talked about the benefit of seeing that. I think I've mentioned already most all of these, if not all of these, things that we do kind of from the state level, the 4K program. We're now serving about 2,500 kids in private settings. We are the state lead agency for Parents as Teachers, which is a wonderful evidence-based home visitation program. Since we are here at the Riley Institute, I will mention that we have been a runner-up in the Riley Institute's What Works South Carolina competition for, I think, two of the past 3 years with Parents as Teachers. Nurse Family Partnership, again, you'll hear a little bit more about. We are the lead agency there for BabyNet. We're also an early Head Start grantee. Well, imagine, if you will, that in the center of this screen is a multicolored graphic that shows a child in the center. One of the things that we have worked on here most recently in collaboration with all of these partners that you see down at the bottom of the screen is a new description of school readiness for South Carolina. This is a roughly a two-page document that is designed to help parents and help the public and help other agency partners understand what it means to be ready for school in South Carolina. It includes information on the kinds of skills and abilities we would expect a child to have. But it also includes descriptions of how parents support this, how families support school readiness, how the community supports school readiness, and the important role that teachers and schools have in supporting school readiness as well. What this is all leading to is something that hopefully maybe looks a little bit familiar to you. Maybe you've seen some of these graphics around the state. As part of the launch of this school readiness description, we have launched a program called I Can, and the idea sort of goes back to that graphic that you couldn't see, and that is that everyone has a role to play in helping to support school readiness. It's not just a responsibility that vests within the child. It's something that parents can help to support. It's something that churches can help support. This is our board chairman, Ken Wingate, talking about one of the things he can do is he can read to his grandchildren. There are a series of billboards around the state that talk about some of the skills like making predictions as we read. So these are the kinds of things that we hope to get you involved with. One of the things that I think Jill had told us early on before we started was that frequently in these summer sessions that one of the things that people want to know is how they can get involved. So I'll leave you with two suggestions. One, if you live in Greenville County, make sure you go visit Derek and see if I'm sure he would be happy to take contributions or volunteer time or what have you. But definitely get involved at the local level. There is a local board in every county, so maybe a way you could contribute is getting involved in that local nonprofit board. The other thing, though, that you can do is as you leave here tonight, think about this I Can campaign and give some thought to what it is in your context that you can do. Sarah gave an example of the grocery store project. My friend Robin Reed's going to talk to you in a minute about Talk to Me, which is a new campaign. But that's a good example of like what role do I as a grocery store manager play? What could I do to help to support school readiness? So it is a responsibility that we all share and an investment that is a really wise public policy one for South Carolina. So thank you very much for the opportunity to be here tonight.
Deputy Director of South Carolina First Steps, speaking at Furman University. Earlier, we featured the addresses given at the Straight Talk SC Education for Life, Working Together to Fulfill the Promise of Education. First speaker was Dr. Sarah Ryder, pediatrician and clinical assistant professor at USC School of Medicine in Greenville. And we also heard from Susan Offert, State Director the South Carolina Department of Social Services. As we mentioned earlier, this is the first in a three-part series in the summer series from the Riley Institute at Furman, as well as the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, entitled Straight Talk SC. Next week, the topic will be No Blank Slates, Families, Communities, and Success and Failure in K-12. Until then, from South Carolina's Department of Education, I'm Doug Keel. This production, a presentation of South Carolina's Department of Education. We deeply appreciate the folks at the Riley Institute and the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Furman for making these programs possible. We'll be back again next week and be speaking of schools.